gasping body of Rufus Lime. The halves dropped separately to earth. I sealed the staff securely. We landed awkwardly amid a clump of palms and pot plants. The boy was busy fainting. Our eyes were closing. I forced them open and set my essence tingling through his system. "Wake up!" He stirred.
"My side."
"Don't look at it. We're all right."
"And Nada?"
"Well, that's not so good." Across the open space, beyond a number of scattered picnic tables and litter bins, the earth was broken, blistered. Where once the kiddies rode the carousel, a smoking crater split the earth. And in that smoke, something big and shapeless roared and stumbled, calling out my name.
"Artemis, I order you, come here. I must chastise you for your impudence."
It no longer looked anything much like a man.
"See how my strength grows, Bartimaeus, despite my pain. See how I shrug off this pathetic coat of flesh."
"Bartimaeus, my side, I can't feel it."
"It's fine. Don't worry about it."
"You're concealing something. That thought... what was it?"
"Nothing. I was thinking we have to get up, get away."
"Where are you, Bartimaeus?"
the great voice called.
"I shall add you to myself. It is an honour."
"My side feels numb. I can't—"
"Relax. I'll see if I can fly us out."
"No, wait. What about Nauda?"
"He's a big boy. He can fly himself if he wants to.
Now, we can't go, Bartimaeus. Not if he's—"
"He'll keep. We're going."
"No!"
I tried to exert my energies to fly, but the boy was actively resisting. The muscles tensed. His will wrestled with my own. We half rose, crashed back down among the ferns, ended up leaning against a tree. One advantage of this, it concealed us from the many eyes of Nauda, now a squatting blackness that scuttled on the crater's lip.
"You idiot, Nathaniel. Let me take over. There isn't any point."
"What do you—"
"Is there? I read your mind just now."
"Oh, that. Look, I'm no medic. Forget it. I could be wrong."
"But you're not, are you? Tell me the truth for once."
A surreptitious rustling in the leaves. I turned our head, grateful for the opportunity to change the subject. "This'll cheer us up," I said heartily. "Here's Kitty." Nathaniel. Her hair was matted and disordered. One side of her face was scratched. But Nathaniel was relieved to see that she seemed otherwise unharmed. Once again his relief revealed itself as anger.
"What are you doing back?" he hissed. "Get away!"
A scowl.
"We've got the commoners clear," she whispered. "And it was no small task. Check out what one of them did to me."
She pointed at the scratch.
"Nice bit of thanks, that is. Anyway, I had to come back to see how you were doing."
Her eyes dropped to rest on Nathaniel's side. They widened.
"What the hell?"
"According to Bartimaeus," Nathaniel said blandly, "it's nothing to worry about." She bent close.
"Oh, God. Can you walk? We've got to get you out."
"Not yet." After the first pain, the numbness had spread fast. Nathaniel felt a little light-headed, but provided he remained still, leaning against the tree, his discomfort was minimal. His mind was clear, or at least it would have been had the jinni not been messing with his thoughts, trying to block out knowledge of his injury, trying to influence his decisions. He spoke quickly.
"Kitty, the attack with the staff failed. The thing's too strong. I tried it at maximum controllable power, but it wasn't enough. Nauda absorbed the energy."
"Well, then," she bit her lip,
"we get you out, then we think again." "Bartimaeus," he said, "what will happen if we leave Nauda now? Speak honestly."
The jinni's answer was delayed by a colossal crashing and rending sound from somewhere behind them. "In time," Bartimaeus said, speaking through Nathaniel's mouth, "Nauda will become bored with the manifold delights of the One World exhibition. He will turn his attention to the rest of London. He will feed on its people, and so swell in size and power. This growth will further stimulate his hunger until either the city lies barren or he bursts. That honest enough for you?
Kitty, Nathaniel said, I have to stop the demon now. But you can't. You just said so. Even at full power, the star failed. Maximum controllable power, I said. There's one way of getting more energy from it, and that's by removing Gladstone's safeguards, the spells that bind the staff. All its power would be unleashed in one fell swoop.
He smiled at her.
I think that might give Nauda pause.
The girl shook her head.
I don't buy it. Who's to say it won't just make him even stronger? Now, Bartimaeus, can't you... There is one other factor to be taken into the equation,
Nathaniel said. With some difficulty, he lifted the staff and gestured toward the roof.
What's this building made of? Glass. And?
Ah, the Jinni's voice cut in at once. You know, reluctant as I am to say it, he might actually have a point there.
Iron,
Nathaniel said.
Iron. And Nauda, being a spirit, is not protected against it. If the staff is broken and it all comes crashing down on him... What do you think, Bartimaeus?
It might work. But there's one small flaw. Kitty made a face.
Exactly. How do you break the staff without being harmed? And what about the roof fall?
Nathaniel stretched. His neck felt cold and stiff.
Leave that to me. We'll be all right.
She looked at him.
Okay. Fine. I'll do this with you. No, you won't. Bartimaeus's protective shields won't extend to you as well. Will they, Bartimaeus?
No.
We'll be all right, Nathaniel said again.
His mind drifted a little. He felt the Jinni prompting him.
Look, he said, I've got 7-league boots on. We'll catch you up. Just get out now and keep on running. Nathaniel, better go, Kitty. Nauda will leave the palace soon, and the chance will be gone.
Kitty stamped her foot.
No way. I'm not going to allow this.
Her defiance warmed him. He grinned at her.
Listen, I'm the magician. You're the commoner. I'm the one who orders you about, remember?
She scowled.
Sure you'll be able to use the boots? Of course, no problem. So I'll see you both outside. Promise?
Yes.
Yes. Now go.
She turned slowly with reluctance, then spun back to him, grasping at her neck.
The amulet! It'll keep you safe!
She held it out, spinning on its chain. The jade stone glinted softly. Nathaniel felt a great weariness.
No, that won't be any good for me.
Tiny glints of light shone in the corners of her eyes.
Why? Why not?
Because... Bartimaeus's voice broke in. It's so powerful a charm. It might absorb too much of the staff's energy and enable Nauda to escape. The best thing you can do is take it and wear it and go now. His voice echoed silently in Nathaniel's head. How's that?
Not bad.
He looked at Kitty. She had halted with the amulet outstretched. Her eyes searched Nathaniel's face. He saw her aura shining all about them, picking out everything in clear, unblemished detail. The tree bark, the veins upon the leaves, the stones and grass about their feet. He felt himself bathed within it. His weariness departed. He pushed himself away from the tree, tapped the staff upon the ground. It flared into life.
See you later, Kitty.
He said. She lowered the amulet around her neck and smiled.
See you. You too, Bartimaeus.
Goodbye. Then she was gone among the trees, away toward the eastern entrance, and Nathaniel was turning away from her, feeling the Jinni's energy supporting his, turning to look across the great expanse at where the monstrosity shambled in its loneliness, tearing and sundering and crying out for food.
What do you think, Bartimaeus?
He thought.
Do we go for it?
I suppose we might as well. Got nothing better to do.
Exactly.
Kitty. Kitty was almost at the entrance when she heard the sound of a voice raised loud behind her, in a tone of imperious command. The answering roar the demon gave made the gravel rattle across the path and set the glass panes shivering in the dome. Then she was shoving open the door and falling out into the cold night air. Her legs shook with the effort. Her arms were as weak and ineffectual as in a dream. Down the steps she went, and away through the ornamental garden, stumbling through tilled soil, veering wildly round low hedges, until she reached the open expanse of park. The light from the great glass palace shone on her back. She saw her shadow stretching out ahead of her upon the illuminated grass. Away, away! If she could get beyond the lights, into the darkness, perhaps then she would rest. She drove herself on, slowing all the while, as her breathing became ever shallower and her muscles ever more laboured, until finally, despite her fury and desperation, she came to a limping halt. At that same moment, she was conscious of a noise, of a dull bulb of sound that seemed almost to swallow itself, flaring and subsiding on the instant. The grass she stood on rose and fell in a little tremor that passed away into the dark. Kitty turned toward the glass palace, sinking to her knees. She was just in time to see its orange glow eaten from within by a dazzling swell of whiteness, which rose up and outward, through the margins of the dome, shattering each and every pane of glass so that the shards exploded into the night. The whiteness hid the palace. It streamed on across the ornamental gardens, ate away the remaining distance, and engulfed Kitty, knocking her backward with its force. The amulet of Samarkand fell hard against her face. Dimly she saw it glowing, drawing in the raging energies. All about her was a fearful rushing. All about her grass burned. Then with equal suddenness the buffeting ceased. The air was raw and still. Kitty opened her eyes. With some difficulty she propped herself upon her elbows. It was very dark. Somewhere, at an unknown distance, a great fire was burning, orange-red. Outlined against it was a complex mess of metal, twisting, bending, fragile as a net of wire. As she watched, it crumpled in upon itself, growing dense and darkly packed. With the faintest of sighs, it subsided into the flames, which rose up to meet it, licked against the sky, and gradually fell back. Kitty lay there, watching. By and by, tiny flecks of glass came tumbling silently out of the night. Within minutes, the earth was glittering like frost. Chapter 37 Kitty. At 9:30 in the morning, precisely 2 days and 5 hours after the explosion in St. James's Park, the Interim Council of the British Government gathered for an emergency meeting. They occupied a pleasant committee room in the Ministry of Employment, which had been largely undamaged by the Whitehall fires. Pale sunlight filtered through the windows. Tea, coffee, and sweet biscuits were in substantial supply. Ms. Rebecca Piper, who presided, directed proceedings with crisp efficiency. Certain matters were immediately attended to: the provision of funds for the care and treatment of the injured, and the annexation of 2 military hospitals for the same purpose. A subsidiary committee, with direct access to the Treasury, was then established to begin restoration work on the city centre. Next came issues of security. A junior minister gave his report. 4 demon hybrids were known to be still at large. All had been driven from the urban areas into rural zones beyond. Imps kept track of their wandering and went ahead to organise evacuations when necessary. Soon expeditionary forces would be assembled to remove the threat. This response was complicated by the near-total destruction of the night police, and the disappearance, presumed death, of its leader, Ms. Farrer. The junior minister hoped that a new, fully human police force might presently be established, and requested authority to begin recruitment, ideally from among the commoners. At this, the commoners' representatives interrupted the discussion to demand resolution of an equally important issue: the return of the troops from America. They cited, as support for their position, the imminent likelihood of rebellions among the occupied states of Europe, and the strong possibility of renewed attacks on London. They hinted that failure to accede to their request would result in widespread strikes and rioting, which would hit the interim government hard. Their air of grim truculence aroused the passions of several magicians, who had to be physically restrained. Miss Piper, banging her gavel repeatedly upon the table, restored order only with the help of the acting secretary, Mr. Harold Button. He added his voice to the commoner's cause, giving, at length, several historical examples where faltering empires had been saved by their loyal troops. After heated debate, Miss Piper put the issue to a vote. By a tight margin, authority was given to order the withdrawal of troops from America. At this, the commoner's representatives asked for a recess, that they might give the news to the people waiting in the street outside. Permission was given. The interim council disbanded, and Mr. Button ordered himself more tea. Kitty, who had watched all this from a chair beside the window, stirred and escaped into the corridor. The heat of their opinions had given her a headache. She had declined Miss Piper's offer the previous morning of a seat among the council. Quite apart from the strangeness of the notion of sitting with magicians as an equal, she knew she did not have the energy required. If the endless debates she'd witnessed back at the Frog Inn were anything to go by, anyone wishing to take part in a more open system of government would need qualities of supreme patience and endurance. Kitty, for the present, had neither of these in great supply. But she did put forward Mr. Button's name, as a surviving magician with a broader view of things than many. Through her contacts at the Frog, she was also able to suggest several prominent commoners, whose presence might give the interim council more validity. After that, she had requested a private room, and retired for a sleep. Late in the afternoon, she had woken and made her way back to St. James's Park. She pushed through the temporary barricades, and entered the dead zone, where purple threads of residual magic hung above a vast circle of hard black ground, crisp as burned carpet. Glass crunched beneath her shoes. The air was foul. Only with the amulet held tightly in her hand could Kitty feel entirely safe. At the centre of the zone, the remnants of the palace hulked dark and tangled against the autumn light. A few spurs of iron protruded. Most were moulded together in a complex weft, like giant brambles, choked and impassable. Magical vapours clung low about them, motionless, as if fused to earth. Their acrid taint made Kitty cough. She stood there quietly for a time. "So much for your promises," she said at last. No answers sounded from the ruins. Nothing stirred. Kitty did not linger. With slow steps, she returned to the living world. At 1 o'clock, when the council broke for its lunchtime recess, Miss Piper went in search of Kitty. She discovered her sitting alone in the ministry library, intermittently flicking through an atlas and staring into space. The magician flopped down opposite, her face heavy with vexation. "Those delegates are being quite impossible," she cried. "Impossible! Not content with forcing through the American motion, by tactics tantamount to blackmail, they have just informed me that they now object to us using imps for surveillance of the ports, though it is manifestly in the national interest. They say it contravenes the rights of the workers there, whatever that might mean." She gave a little pout. "It is blatant posturing. Mr. Button has just thrown a bun at them." Kitty shrugged. "Security's important, but so's the trust of the people. Spies, vigilance spheres, all that's going to have to change. As far as the ports go, you'll just have to argue it out with them, I suppose." "Are you sure we can't persuade you to take part?" Miss Piper said. "You would be a perfect intermediary between us and the more extreme factions." "Sorry," Kitty said. "I'm tired. I'd just get stroppy. You'd be packing me off to the tower by nightfall." "I hardly think so." Miss Piper seemed suddenly thoughtful. "Mind you, some of those delegates... The idea is tempting." She shook her head. "What am I saying?" "So then, Miss Jones, I see you have an atlas out. Does this indicate your plans?"
"I don't know," Kitty said slowly. "I think maybe
when things calm down a little on the continent, I'll go abroad for a while. I've got a friend to visit in Bruges, and after that I'd like to travel a bit, see the world. I hope it will help me regain my health. She pursed her lips, looked toward the window. Perhaps I'll go to Egypt. I've heard a lot about it. I don't know. It all depends. You wouldn't care to continue your magical studies here? Mr. Button speaks highly of your aptitude, and we have a conspicuous lack of talent in the government. We could recommend some tutors.
Kitty shut the atlas cover. Spirals of dust rose up and drifted in the light.
You are very kind, but that door's closed to me now. My studies were always directed towards summoning one particular...
She paused.
I had one particular objective in mind, and 2 nights ago Nathaniel accomplished it for me. In all honesty, I wouldn't know how to follow on from that.
There was silence in the room. All at once, Miss Piper looked at her watch and gave a little cry.
Recess is almost over. I must go. Heaven knows whether we can make any headway this afternoon.
She sighed heavily as she stood.
Miss Jones, after a single morning, I am already close to throttling the commoner's entire delegation. A single morning, and we are barely started. The outlook could hardly be worse. I really don't believe we shall be able to cooperate at all.
Kitty smiled and sat back in her chair.
Keep trying, she said. It's possible. Not easy, but it's possible. You'll be surprised what you manage to achieve.
Chapter 38 Bartimaeus. Dying was the simple part. Our main problem was catching Nauda's attention. We stood, the two of us, in our single body, directly beneath the middlemost dome. This was the place to lure him to. The epicenter. The place of maximum iron. But Nauda was too big, too noisy, too confused and desolate to be easily lured. Back and forth he lurched on his mess of limbs, trampling stalls and kiddies' rides, and stuffing trees at random into his gaping mouth. He undertook this serious work with admirable conviction, and none of his eyes were turned our way. Flying was out for us now. Even bounding would be a stretch. It took most of my remaining energies to keep the boy upright. Left to his own devices, he'd have crumpled to the floor. So we stopped where we were, and shouted instead. Or at least I did, with the kind of cry that triggers Tibetan avalanches. When shouted from Nepal, that's how loud it was. Nauda! It is I, Bartimaeus, Sakral Jinni, Ngorso the Mighty and the Serpent of Silver Plumes. I have fought 1,000 battles and won them all. I have destroyed far greater entities than you. Ramuthra fled before my majesty. Chu cowered in a crack in the earth. Hoipo, the thunder snake, ingested his own tail and so swallowed himself rather than taste my fury. So then, I challenge you now. Come face me. No answer. Nauda was busily munching on some of the exhibits in the Grotto of Taxidermy. The boy ventured a tentative thought.
Does that count as a goad? It was essentially straightforward boasting, wasn't it?
Listen, a goad's anything that provokes or incites an enemy, and...
Oh, look, it didn't work, did it? We're running out of time. Another few steps and he'll break outside. Let me have a go.
The boy cleared his throat.
Cursed demon! You have met your end! The shivering fire awaits you. I shall spread your vile essence across this hall like margarine. A very thick layer of it.
He hesitated. Yes, I'm not sure he'll pick up on that analogy. Never mind, keep going.
Cursed demon, attend to me.
The pity of it was that the boy's voice was desperately faint and growing fainter. I could barely hear it, let alone Nauda. But he finished up with a very effective extra, namely a bolt of force from the staff that jabbed Nauda sharply in the rear. The Great Spirit responded with a roar. He rose up, limbs twitching, bulb eyes questing. All at once he saw us and sent multiple bolts, crashing all around. His aim was lousy. One or two landed a few meters distant, but we stood firm. We did not budge. The great voice,
"Bartimaeus, I see you."
The boy whispered something in reply, too weak to hear. But I read his mind, spoke the words for him.
"No, I am Nathaniel. I am your master. I am your death."
Another burst of white energy pricked Nauda's essence. He hurled a stuffed bear aside and turned in ponderous wrath. He came crawling toward us, a colossal shadow, alien to this world, sundered from the other, blocking out the light.
"Now that's what you call a proper goad,"
Nathaniel thought. "Yeah, it wasn't bad." "Right. Wait till he's on top of us. Then we break the staff."
"The longer it takes, the better. Kitty..."
"She'll get out. Don't worry." The boy's strength was failing, but his resolution was undaunted. I felt him summon his remaining powers. Steadily, calmly, muttering under his breath, he loosed the bonds restraining Gladstone's staff, until all at once the hopes of the entities trapped inside were raised. They pushed, strained, pressed against the remaining loops of magic, desperate to be free. Without my assistance, Nathaniel could not have controlled them. They would have instantly broken through. But Nauda was not yet where we wanted him. I held the staff in place. There was nothing now to do but wait. According to some, generally those who don't have to do it, politicians and writers spring to mind, heroic deaths are admirable things. I've never been convinced by this argument, mainly because no matter how cool, stylish, composed, unflappable, manly, or defiant you are, at the end of the day you're also dead. Which is a little too permanent for my liking. I've made a long and successful career out of running away at the decisive moment, and it was with some considerable regret, as Nauda bore down upon us in that soaring tomb of iron and glass, that I realized I didn't actually have this fallback option. I was bound to the boy, essence to flesh. We were going out together. The nearest I'd ever come to this dubious last-stand business before was with Ptolemy. In fact, he'd only prevented it with his final intervention. I suppose if my old master could have seen me now, he'd probably have approved. It was right up his street, this. You know, human and jinni united, working together as one, etc., etc. Trouble was, we'd taken it all a bit too literally.
"Bartimaeus?"
The thought was very faint.
"Yes?" "You've been a good servant."
"What do you say to something like this? I mean, with death bearing down, and a 5,000-year career of incomparable accomplishment about to hit the fan." The appropriate response, frankly, is some sort of rude gesture, followed up by the loudest of raspberries. But again I was stymied. Being in his body made the logistics too cumbersome to bother with. Well, try giving yourself a rude gesture. It just doesn't work, does it? So, wearily, wishing we had some kind of maudlin soundtrack, I played along. "Well, you've been just dandy, too."
"I didn't say you were perfect."
"What?"
"Far from it. Let's face it, you've generally managed to cock things up."
"What? The bloody cheek! Insults at a time like this, with death bearing down, etc. I ask you." I rolled up my metaphorical sleeves. "Well, since we're doing some straight talking, let me tell you, buddy..."
"Which is why I'm dismissing you right now."
"Eh?" But I hadn't misheard. I knew I hadn't. I could read his mind.
"Don't take it the wrong way."
His thought was fragmented, fleeting, but his mouth was already mumbling the spell.
"It's just that we've got to break the staff at the right moment here. You're holding it in check, but I can't rely on you for something as important as this. You're bound to mess it up somehow. Best thing is to dismiss you. That'll trigger the staff automatically. Then I know it'll be done properly.
He drifted. He was having trouble keeping awake now. The energy was draining unhindered from his side. But with a final effort of will, he kept speaking the necessary words. Nathaniel?
Say hello to Kitty for me.
Then Nauda was upon us. Mouths open, tentacles slashed down. Nathaniel finished the dismissal. I went. The staff broke. A typical master. Right to the end, he didn't give me a chance to get a word in edgeways. Which is a pity, because at that last moment I'd have liked to tell him what I thought of him. Mind you, since in that split second we were, to all intents and purposes, one and the same, I rather think he knew anyway. This is Simon Jones. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of the Bartimaeus Trilogy, Book 3, Ptolemy's Gate, by Jonathan Stroud. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler, Executive Producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2006 by Jonathan Stroud. Production copyright 2006, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Hello, this is Jim Dale, narrator of the Harry Potter audiobook series. Listening to audiobooks isn't just great entertainment. It's also a great way for your family to experience and enjoy books together. Studies have shown that listening to stories read aloud helps children build vocabulary, improve their reading skills, and succeed more readily in school. It's an important step on the road to becoming a good reader, and one of the best ways to help ensure a lifelong love of literature for the children you care about. Check your local retailer for the wide selection of audiobooks available from Listening Library. Or if you would like to visit us online for more information, check our website at www.listeninglibrary.com. Thank you, and happy listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.